So the title of my talk is Evolution and Ethics, Suffering, Moral Evil, and Virtue. I suspect that most of us have heard, if not ourselves, said, what is this world coming to? It's not a bad question when we're discussing evolution, not a bad question at all. Yet that question is not ordinarily prompted by information or conversations about evolution. More often than not, it arises when tragedy strikes of some sort. A random shooting in a movie theater. Planes crashing into buildings, killing thousands. Or the systematic massacring of people. We tend to ask the question because people have done something that shocks us. Something that seems beyond what we could imagine. Something terribly wrong. People intentionally hurt other people, or us, and we wonder where this could possibly have come from, and where it will take us. Professor Domning considered at length the question of what is called physical evil this morning. I'd like to reflect with you on moral evil, which he touched on, of course, as well. That wrongdoing which finds its source in human beings. A preliminary remark would be helpful regarding the criteria for judging when something is morally wrong in contemporary Catholic moral theology. Our theology made a shift, a significant shift, in the mid-20th century to what is called person-centered reasoning or morality, with the result that an action is judged as morally evil when it conflicts with authentic human good, the authentic human good of the person. As John Paul II stated in his encyclical from 1993, The Splendor of Truth. Now, even though the Catholic tradition judges actions as morally wrong when one intentionally harms authentic human good, it has a fuller description of the consequences of misusing one's freedom in a document from 1965, the Vatican II document on the Constitution on the Church in the Modern World. When it noted that humanity's abuse of freedom results in a rupturing of a fourfold relationship with God, with others, with oneself, and all created things. So the whole of the created world is included among relationships with persons. So while the tradition now consistently speaks of the moral agent in this fourfold relationship with God, others, self, and creation, it suggests that we are only scratching the surface as to how the relationship with all of creation might enter into moral analysis. Yet in light of what we are discussing here, in light of evolution itself, it seems all the more essential to attend to the close relationship that humanity has with all of creation. Now I return to the question, what is this world coming to? I think it's safe to say that we long for a world like that described in the book of Revelation, chapter 21, where we read, "Then I saw a new heaven and a new earth. The former heaven and the former earth had passed away, and the sea was no more. I also saw the holy city, a new Jerusalem, coming down out of heaven from God, prepared as a bride adorned for her husband. I heard a loud voice from the throne saying, 'Behold, God's dwelling is with the human race. He will dwell with them, and they will be his people, and God himself will always be with them as their God. God will wipe every tear from their eyes, and there shall be no more death or mourning, wailing or pain, for the old order has passed away.' The one who sat on the throne said, 'Behold, I make all things new.'" This vision of Revelation captures, I suspect, where we hope the world is heading, where there's no more tears or mourning or death itself. Yet we find ourselves in a world of tears and death, of mourning, of wailing and pain. It's a world captured by St. Paul in his letter to the Romans, chapter 8, verses 18 to 23, where he reflects on the vision to come, this paradise, while in the midst of an imperfect and sinful world. He says, I consider the sufferings of this present time as nothing compared with the glory to be revealed for us. For creation awaits with eager expectation the revelation of the children of God. For creation was made subject to futility, not of its own accord, but because of the one who subjected it, in hope that creation itself would be set free from slavery to corruption and share in the glorious freedom of the children of God. We know that all creation is groaning in labor pains even until now. And not only that, but we ourselves, who have the first fruits of the Spirit, we also groan within ourselves as we wait for adoption, the redemption of our bodies. So in these times between the Big Bang and the fulfillment of the vision of the book of Revelation, we find ourselves, like St. Paul, in a world touched by a variety of experiences of suffering. And sometimes we ask, what is this world coming to? As I said, I will focus on moral evil as a source of suffering and see what challenges and insights from theories of evolution might assist us in this reflection. And then also, with reference to insights from theories of evolution, I'll reflect briefly on human virtues called for in such a world and identify seeds of human virtue in the seemingly empathic behavior of non-human animals. A first question, however, is, do traditional categories of moral theology regarding freedom and responsibility hold up in light of the emergence of humanity, or are they an illusion? In other words, is there truly moral evil that arises from free and responsible human beings, or are these harmful actions of human beings simply another example of physical evil in a broken world, or actions that must take place in the ongoing process of natural selection? Or is there a middle ground between this either-or proposal? First, a word about moral evil itself and this particular type of suffering. Franciscan Dr. Daniel Solmazy speaks of three ways in which moral evil may be operative as a cause for suffering. The first, he says, is suffering which is a result of our own moral evil, but without any intervening material occasion. So, for example, pangs of conscience, remorse, or guilt. I remember, for example, a young man who had an affair and undid the bond with his wife, which became the cause of divorce in their relationship. They had three children. He never got over the harm that he did to his family. So even though his relationship with them was friendly, he suffered tremendously because of his own moral failure. The source of his suffering was his own remorse over his wrongdoing. There was nothing there materially to cause him suffering. The second type of suffering, Solmazy says, is the result of moral evil of others without, again, any intervening material occasion. So we can imagine the experience of somebody who is not invited to participate in a conference like this who's really an expert on that. They might suffer because of that, because they're saying, what's the matter with me? Or the experience of someone who is intentionally left out of a family event. Or the experience of someone marginalized because of race or for some other reason. Intentional exclusion would be hurtful, although we would have no physical bruises to show for our suffering. The third kind of suffering is the result of a moral evil of self or others mediated through material occasions of suffering. And the long and horrible list of examples include self-mutilation, torture, assault, rape, poisoning, murder, war, willful negligence, and so many others. Here the examples speak for themselves. Catholic moral theology would suggest that the three types of suffering here are not due to accidents or to that unhappy phrase, acts of God, but from moral evil, whether occasioned by some material cause or not. In traditional moral theology, two qualities are necessary for living the moral life and for an act to be judged truly human: freedom to exercise one's will, and consciousness or knowledge about what one intends to do. When these two characteristics are present, a person may be held responsible for his or her actions. Absent these two qualities, one may speak of an act of a human person, but not a truly human act. So if you're driving down an icy road and you slide into the other lane and injure someone in oncoming traffic, we call that an accident, because you did not knowingly and willingly try to do that. On the other hand, if you're driving your Humvee down Route 95 and somebody's going 30 miles an hour in the left lane and you nudge them a little bit, that might be considered a truly human act, and you want to bring about someone, you want to hurt that person, at least you want them out of the lane. I'm speaking from experience, but I don't drive a Humvee. Now, if we look back at these three examples of suffering, we may see that the cause of suffering is associated with human choices made with freedom and knowledge, which in one way or another harmed others, were the source of suffering for the victim and even for the one who caused the harm. Now, according to the Catholic tradition, then, the question of the existence of moral evil, indeed morality itself, then, hinges on freedom and knowledge. Boston College moral theologian Stephen Pope says, morality itself would be fatally compromised if science somehow demonstrated that human freedom and moral responsibility were illusions. Whether demonstrated or not, some scientists suggest that human freedom and moral responsibility are illusions. Pope summarizes the thought of some contemporary evolutionists precisely on the question of freedom and consequently moral responsibility and moral evil. What do some of these thinkers say, and how might we counter arguments? William Provine, representing an extreme view of neo-Darwinists, suggests that according to modern science, quote, free will as it is traditionally conceived, the freedom to make uncoerced and unpredictable choices among alternative courses of action, simply does not exist. There is no way that the evolutionary process as currently conceived can produce a being that is truly free to make moral choices. Close quote. On what basis might Provine or others make this claim? For some thinkers, the presumption is that natural selection and random events have produced the creatures that we are today. If this is the case, then it's foolish to speak of freedom and responsibility. We're simply the products of evolution and have evolved as every other species in order to continue in being as individuals and as a species. All of our behavior is about fitness. And behavior today continues to be guided by that evolutionary drive. For others, the cause of human behavior is attributed to genes alone, a kind of genetic determinism. Sometimes to an interaction between genes and environment, a type of environmental determinism. But ultimately, the notion that we human beings are free and responsible for what we do is counted illusory. E.O. Wilson writes, "The agent itself is created by the interaction of genes and the environment. It would appear that our freedom is only a self-delusion. In a sense, we do what we are programmed to do by natural selection, by genes alone, or by genes in interaction with the environment." Pope criticizes these arguments by three points in particular. First, he points out that sociobiologists and evolutionary psychologists who hold this position concerning human freedom and ultimately the possibility to live the moral life and to cause moral evil, that they rely on a presupposition that the only way that we can understand all of reality is through the scientific method. Pope does not question in any way the validity of the scientific method, but suggests that scientists are mistaken to presume that this method is sufficient and the only way to understand and to explain the whole of reality, particularly our experience as conscious and free human beings. He says, quote, "There is a difference between trying to use science to explain as much about phenomena as possible and assuming that science alone has the ability to fully explain all phenomena. There's also an important difference," he writes, "between employing science to discover whatever can be known about the material world and assuming that the material world alone is real." John Polkinghorne concurs when he says, "The boundary set by science does not negate the meaning of inquiry and practice beyond that boundary. Rather, it demarks the onset of other dimensions of human knowledge and action." Pope's second critique specifies a bit further the first. He looks at the difficulty of presuming to explain or to understand the whole of anything, but of human beings in particular, as only the sum of its parts. This would be called a mereological relationship between the parts and the whole, where entities belonging to a given level, except those at the very bottom, have an exhaustive decomposition without remainder into entities belonging at lower levels. Entities at the very bottom have no physically significant proper parts. So if there is no evidence or capacity for freedom and consciousness and moral responsibility in the part at the lower level, the argument says, how could there be in the whole? Pope responds, quote, "that living organisms manifest properties that are not reducible to the properties of their physical and chemical components. Wholes can possess emergent properties that do not exist in their individual components taken as isolated units." He speaks of holism as descriptive of an evolutionary process where one sees, quote, "the gradual emergence of more and more intricate and complex webs of reciprocal influence." Conway Morris also notes that organisms are more than the sum of their parts, and he compares Dawkins' explanation in terms of genes alone as an attempt to describe a picture by addressing the way the different colors were formed and so forth. Polkinghorne says that if a scientist were asked to articulate everything that he or she could with regard to music from a scientific viewpoint, they might speak of a neural response to the impact of sound waves on the eardrum. But the deep mystery of music, experienced as timeless beauty, cannot be captured there, any more than the whole of a symphony can be appreciated by playing the single notes of the part of the second violin. Implicit in the part versus whole critique is the notion of emerging complexity that I think we saw this morning, which Pope accounts for the existence of freedom and consciousness in human beings. He points out that evolution witnesses to the fact that nature as a whole is organized in such a way as to produce more and more complexity and higher capacities for responsiveness, intelligence, and consciousness. The existence of Homo sapiens is evidence of such emerging complexity. One attempt at explaining emerging complexity is the debated notion of downward causation, which suggests, as Richard Campbell and Mark Brickard note, complex systems, in virtue of their macro-level properties, are able to bring about changes at lower levels. Pope notes further that the essential implication of the notion of human emergent complexity is that the human good embraces all aspects of human nature, not only the physical, chemical, and biological, but also the social, cultural, psychological, and emotional, the intellectual, moral, and religious dimensions of human existence. So far from being reduced to the sum of its parts, this whole possesses the capacity to feel, to reflect, relate, deliberate, act, and to be held accountable for his or her actions. Pope's third point may appear more an assertion than an argument, but he appeals to human experience itself. So while acknowledging factors that influence the existence of freedom, Pope writes, every person has the daily experience of deciding to act in one way or another, on the basis of good reasons, or moral principle, or an overriding loyalty, or as a desired goal. To dismiss all of these motives as illusory, or as slaves of deeper genetically driven motivations, runs too profoundly against the experience of what it means to be human, to be persuasive. So the bottom line for Pope is that there does seem to be evidence, both in evolution and certainly in human experience, to speak credibly of free persons who have the ability to deliberate and to make choices. To say, though, that persons are free and that they have knowledge, and that this is part of the human reality, is not to suggest that human knowing and the exercise of freedom take place in a vacuum and that they are not influenced by internal and external factors. Rather, we recognize that human experience presumes some degree of self-direction, some degree of self-direction and self-determination within contexts that are to a large extent not of that human person's own making. So freedom is exercised by limited human beings. The Catholic tradition has long noted impediments or obstacles to fully human acts, those acts that presume knowledge and freedom, and those acts for which we might be held responsible. Traditionally, ignorance was the greatest obstacle to knowledge, not surprisingly. For example, someone goes out hunting and shoots a person thinking that he's shooting a deer. We call it an accident because the person did not knowingly shoot to kill a human being. Ignorance presented an impediment to knowledge. And we go into, there are also distinctions about whether this is ignorance that you had an ability to overcome and you should have overcome or not. Bottom line is it's presented this impediment. With regard to freedom, the tradition noted factors affecting full freedom, like the threat of violence. When we hear a POW say something that's uncharacteristic, the threat of violence, fear, emotions, and ongoing personality traits, ongoing impediments, such as personality traits, poor education, prejudice, harmful habitual behavior, and so forth. So the tradition has recognized that there are these obstacles to the exercise, these determining factors in the exercise of freedom and knowledge. That being said, perhaps the most significant aspect of freedom, though, as understood in the moral life, is not simply that a moral agent has the ability to choose that, this or that course of action. Rather, it is that in making these choices, one is shaping oneself as a person. So Karl Rahner wrote that freedom is the capacity to make oneself once and for all, the capacity which of its nature is directed towards the freely willed finality of the subject as such. So freedom has this twofold effect of making a choice for a particular action, but also making a choice about the type of person one will become through the exercise of that freedom. So one who consistently tells the truth becomes trustworthy and is known as such. By contrast, one who lies will be known as such, a liar, dishonest. Trustworthy and dishonest are not merely words applied to actions. In fact, they ordinarily are not used that way. They refer to persons, and precisely to the kind of person a moral agent has become due to his or her particular choices. There's some wisdom from Professor Dumbledore of Harry Potter fame, who says to Harry, "It's our choices, Harry, that show what we truly are, far more than our abilities." So when we consider the evolution of human beings, we must note the influence of the process of evolution itself, particularly with its bent towards selfishness, and the way it affects the exercise of freedom in human beings. We recognize as well the limiting effects that realities such as personal and social sin have on the shaping of persons. Dr. Domning this morning, his point was the harmful effect of sinful social situations, that culturally learned selfish behavior reinforces genetically determined selfish behavior. So these influences are certainly here. But at the same time, we must recognize the positive impact of the evolutionary process and the positive impact of the goodness of other people on moral agents. While acknowledging that human freedom presumes the ability to shape oneself into a particular type of person, we must recognize that the capacity to do this varies greatly depending on the particular context of the moral agent. So when moral theology addresses the existence of freedom in terms of certain theories of evolution, it addresses more than the ability of a moral agent to make this or that choice. More significantly, it speaks of the capacity to shape the interior of the person toward or away from what is good, toward or away from the vision of the book of Revelation with which I began the talk. Moral theologian Paul Waddell summarizes well the purpose of freedom within Christian ethics when he says, "In Christianity, freedom does not exist for its own sake. Rather, freedom exists for the sake of doing good in all the ways good can be done. Freedom is for the sake of justice and love, for the sake of mercy and compassion. Freedom is given us so that we can be generous, patient, and faithful. In Christianity, freedom hinges on loving and desiring the good. Freedom is for excellence. And this means that the perfection of freedom is found not in the person of power and wealth, but in the virtuous person, in the saint." Concluding the first part here, then, returning to the situations of suffering that we described at the beginning, it seems in the view of some scholars whose work I presented here that free persons exist. We meet them and interrelate with them in actions and in reactions. We are not deluded in judging them to be free. They are not deluded in considering themselves free. Freedom and knowledge constitute the essentials of human moral action. Persons are not free from internal and external factors that affect them. Those who use their freedom to harm others, as in situations of suffering described, have abused their freedom and may rightly be held responsible. They have used it not for justice and love, but for harm and evil. The result is moral evil and suffering brought about through human agency. What might be the proper human response to suffering? More particularly, what kind of persons ought we seek to become so as to be able to respond to suffering, whether it arises from physical evil or moral evil? 30 years ago, Dr. Eric Cassell wrote a seminal work on suffering in the New England Journal of Medicine. He said that suffering is, quote, experienced by persons, not merely by bodies, and has its source in challenges that threaten the intactness of the person as a complex social and psychological entity. Although Cassell is writing from his experience as a physician, his description of suffering and its effects rings true, it seems to me, including for those who suffer from physical evil and those from moral evil. All we have to do is look at the news of the people in the wake of Hurricane Sandy. There's a real sense that their external and internal worlds are not intact anymore. People who are suffering will feel that their world is coming apart. In teaching courses on bioethics and sacraments of reconciliation and anointing of the sick over the years, I always begin with reflection on suffering. And I ask the students what feelings they associate with suffering. While many feelings surface, such as confusion, anger, resentment, fear, invariably the bottom line revolves around feelings of isolation from oneself. We even say, if somebody says how you're feeling and we don't quite feel right, we say, "I don't quite feel myself." There's a sense of alienation or isolation from oneself, from others, and often from God. So sufferers experience alienation. What brings comfort to sufferers? More often than not, it is simply the presence of another, the presence of one who they know cares for them. I don't downplay, or in fact, I think it's important to find the cause and the cure of suffering. But oftentimes, most comforting is the sense of belonging that is communicated to the sufferer by the presence of one who is with him or her. So two aspects to the comfort: the presence and the care of the other, which is expressed through presence and action. Now, sometimes the presence is experienced simply by physical presence, sitting quietly with a person who has discovered that her husband has been unfaithful, holding the hand of someone who is undergoing chemotherapy, listening quietly as someone tells of an act of prejudice against them. Other times, there's more than presence alone, assisting a woman to figure out what the next steps will be for her and her family in the wake of her husband's affair, driving someone to the hospital for treatments, painting a garage door that was spray-painted with racial epithets. Whether something is done or not, it is the care behind the action, what we would term a virtuous action, that brings comfort to the one who is suffering. Now, are we able to detect virtuous-like behavior in other animals that might be the seeds of human virtue, particularly regarding responses to suffering? My focus here is precisely on evolutionary roots for virtuous behavior in non-human animals. But it's worth pointing out that there is evidence of cooperation at all levels of evolution. At the APEL conference in this Adam and Eve series, Dr. Ulanovitz spoke of the precedence of mutuality to competition. He said it's ironical that today one continually encounters conferences and papers devoted to resolving how observed mutualisms could possibly arise out of a natural world that is driven everywhere by competition. That problem, of course, is ill-posed, because it is mutuality that is fundamental, and out of which competition ultimately derives. So is there evidence from the non-human world of pre-virtuous behavior, if you will? An example might help. Franz De Waal tells the story of a chimpanzee named Jakey who helped an older chimpanzee named Crom. In the area where the chimpanzees were in this zoo, apparently they had tires, which must have been there for their entertainment. Well, at the end of the day, the zookeeper would hose down the tires and hang them on this log in the enclosure. This particular day, there was water remaining in one of the tires, the seventh tire in on this log, and Crom had an interest in that. So she went over and for about 10 minutes tried to pull that tire that had the water in it off of this log and was unsuccessful. Attributing some human sentiment, she was frustrated and she went back. Jakey, who was a 7-year-old chimp whom Crom had cared for when he was a juvenile, sees what's going on. He promptly went over and he pulled off the 6 tires on the log that were in front of the one that Crom was after, then removes that one, carefully not spilling the water, and he brings the tire to Crom, who immediately began to scoop the water out of the tire. Now, why did Jake do what he did? I have to say, I don't know. But De Waal argues, and I think he would say, I don't know too, but this is what he says, that we find roots of human morality in the behavior of Jakey and in other animals. There's no time to get into it here, and I have limited knowledge of it, but the work with bonobos by De Waal and by Susan Savage Rumbaugh is also fascinating. Just check out you Google her, Susan Savage Rumbaugh, she has a YouTube of it. It's a TED lecture. It's fascinating. And we don't want to imitate the bonobos and everything, but there is something, obviously, that is worth imitating. De Waal says about them, he says, we are looking about the bonobos. We're looking at an animal so akin to ourselves that the dividing line is seriously blurred. So, how does Dewahl read the actions of Jakey, the younger chimpanzee? He suggests that in this instance, Jakey was moved emotionally to help Prom. But he also suggests that Jakey has some kind of a cognitive awareness of Prom's feelings. Dewahl offers the image of a Russian doll as instructive of describing how empathy works in non-human animals and in humans as well. At the core, and what we might find in many animal species, is what he calls the perception-action mechanism. So at the sight of the suffering of another, there is a response on the part of the observer. It is an emotional response. Dewahl speaks of it as an emotional contagion, where the mere sight of the suffering of another stirs an emotional response within the animal or the human. The second level of the Russian doll is cognitive empathy, where the observer comes to some understanding of the reasons for the other's emotions. Dewahl would suggest that Jakey understood in some way the difficulty that Krom had in getting the tire, and even that Krom was interested in the water in the tire. Then the outer level of the Russian doll he calls attribution, where the observer comes to adopt as completely as possible the perspective of the other. And Dewahl argues that attribution is not possible without the other two levels. So it would seem that attribution, in the sense of actually understanding the perspective of the other, is most possible for human beings, but that this ability arises through the process of evolution, which provides building blocks for our present abilities. In other words, attribution would not have been possible without emotional contagion and cognitive analysis. There is not time to address it here, but there is something appealing about the role that Dewahl attributes to emotion as stirring one to action. In particular, how emotion might be the most fundamental motivator of human action. For too long in the Catholic tradition, emotions were viewed primarily as negative influences on human actions, things that got in the way of free actions, and not for the way that they move people to charity, to justice, to mercy. A caution regarding Dewahl is that his approach may seem too close to intuitionism and emotionalism, where one acts based more on one's gut and on feelings than on reason in dialogue with one's gut and one's feelings. So important here is not to say on reason alone. It's reason in dialogue with one's gut and feelings. He raises good points with regard to the role that emotions play in response to in the non-human and the human world. Now, he has also been criticized for an excessively anthropomorphic analysis of human behavior. But to a non-specialist like myself, his observations have some merit, as he attempts to explain, for example, why an ape might pick up an injured bird and attempt to throw it in the air to help it to fly again, or why a chimp might come over and put his arm over the shoulder of another chimp who has just lost a fight. Something's going on there, and we can only use our own language. There are other evolutionary thinkers who see the development of altruistic behavior in non-human animals as roots of altruistic behavior in us. Stephen Pope summarizes the thought of some. He points first to kin altruism, where organisms can be expected to prefer to aid other organisms to the extent which they share genetic similarity. It's suggested that this behavior accounts in part for the tendency among human beings to prefer kin to non-kin, and may account in part for our xenophobia rather than our trust in strangers. A second type of altruism is termed reciprocal altruism by Robert Trivers, and he proposes that biologically unrelated individuals will trade beneficial acts under certain circumstances. Robert Wright explored this notion further in his work, The Moral Animal, where he writes at length of tit-for-tat behavior in non-human animals, from bats to chimpanzees. A third theory suggests group selection provides the grounds for altruism. This theory, proposed by Elliot Sober and David S. Wilson, suggests that altruism within a group would be reasonable if it is beneficial to the individual in that group, whereas if the individual lived in a non-altruistic group, the same individual would not be as well off. Pope says that there is no difficulty whatsoever in looking at the overlap between evolutionary theories of evolution and Christian interpretations of an ethics of love, as long as a Christian interpretation of the ethics of love is not somehow reduced to what we know of altruistic behavior in non-human animals. Each of the theories of altruism described by Pope presumes at the core altruistic behavior that is somehow motivated by selfish concerns. Wright put it this way regarding reciprocal altruism. He said, if indeed the genetically selfish roots of sympathy and benevolence are grounds for despair, then extreme despair is in order. For the more you ponder reciprocal altruism's finer points, the more mercenary the genes seem. Acknowledging selfish roots, Stephen Pope says, while striving to develop, hone, and deepen our evolved natural tendency to care for self, family, and friends, Christian ethics also takes deliberate steps to extend our concern beyond these spheres, to encompass what sociobiologists call non-kin and non-reciprocators. For its part, Christian ethics offers a helpful warning to sociobiologists that we should not confuse our natural bent to self with the full scope of our moral responsibilities to others. What are marks of authentic human virtue? Given that even the best of virtuous behavior in the animal world may be characterized as selfish at some level, are human beings destined to this same kind of behavior? Or might we, through the gift of consciousness and freedom, and more particularly through grace, choose to act in a different way? May we not choose to be different? For example, some evolutionists read the golden rule to love one's neighbor as oneself as a form of reciprocal altruism, where one acts for the good of another with the expectation that there will be a payback. Or Richard Alexander interprets the Good Samaritan parable as an exercise in indirect altruism, where one acts in such a way in order to build up one's reputation and to place oneself in a better position. Pope says, however, that these interpretations run contrary to the actual purpose of the Golden Rule and the parable. The follower of Jesus Christ is expected to act lovingly toward the neighbor and stranger, regardless of payback. The Samaritan is motivated by compassion rather than by enlightened self-interest. And this is the key to human virtue. What motivates the moral agent? What the moral agent intends? Human love, including Christian love, and indeed all love, is inevitably, Pope writes, a psychological reality that includes the motivations and intentions of agents. So human virtue presumes not simply a particular action, but an action done in a virtuous way. For example, one may intend to help a person who has been beaten and robbed, and do so for the sake of boosting one's reputation. But to judge whether such an act is genuinely virtuous, one does not simply look to whether the victim has been helped or not. One looks to the motives and the intentions of the helper. If these motives and intentions are self-serving, they are not fully virtuous. We have to recognize that all motivations are mixed. But with virtuous behavior, one's primary motive and intentions, these are not self-serving. Although, ironically, virtuous behavior does ultimately shape us as people who are better disciples of Jesus Christ. But far from doing virtuous deeds for purposes of self-promotion, one does them because seeking goodness is what it means to be human. Again, Paul Waddell says, we are not virtuous in a complete and unqualified sense Until we perform acts of justice, mercy, compassion, or forgiveness, not only characteristically, but also with a certain pleasure and ease. Thus, a virtuous person does the good not because she is constrained to it, but because she embodies goodness. She enjoys doing good because she enjoys being herself. Now, I can almost hear, though, an argument that if virtuous behavior serves us to make us persons into who we intend to be, then it is self-serving. But it depends on what we mean by the self. I may intend to form myself as one who is more open to loving others. Self is not necessarily a negative term. Whereas in natural selection, the ultimate goal is to survive, to continue in being, Christian ethics points to one Jesus Christ whose ultimate goal was to love others, first the Father, and then the Father's love, or the Father's loves, and to do so at whatever cost. So whereas in the ordinary understanding of the process of evolution, losing one's life would appear the ultimate loss, losing one's life while remaining faithful in love is the ultimate gain in Christian ethics. So what virtues are particularly necessary for a world of suffering? I'd suggest at least two: mercy and solidarity. These are particularly what we see in God's action throughout salvation history, but most especially in the incarnation and in the life, death, and resurrection of his Son. There are certainly other virtues necessary for a suffering world, such as compassion and justice. But mercy and solidarity perhaps presume these and specify them a bit further. So mercy is a scriptural understanding of mercy, as you know, to use the word hesed, which is ordinarily presented as a covenantal relationship where both parties are expected to remain faithful. Yet scripture, in our experience, tells us God is the one who remains faithful, and we often do not. Yet even in the face of infidelity on the part of Israel and of us, God remains faithful. John Paul wrote in his encyclical Rich in Mercy in 1980 that a deeper aspect of hesed showed itself as what it was at the beginning. That is, as love that gives, love more powerful than betrayal, grace stronger than sin. So mercy implies faithful love, faithful presence, even in the face of betrayal. Mercy in Scripture is also presented in the graphic image of a womb, rahamim, indicating the life-giving nature of mercy, the effect of mercy on the one who receives it. Contemporary theologian James Keenan describes mercy as the willingness to enter into the chaos of others. Sister Julia Upton speaks of it as the compassionate care for others, whereby one takes on the burden of another as one's own. Jesuit John Sabrina describes mercy as a basic attitude toward the suffering of another, whereby one reacts to eradicate that suffering for the sole reason that it exists. Mercy may show itself in a variety of moral choices, but these actions are genuinely merciful and virtuous when they flow from a heart that is centered on the other and intent on being present to the other in suffering and alleviating that suffering, if at all possible. The second virtue is solidarity. John Paul describes it as not a feeling of vague compassion or shallow distress at the misfortunes of so many people, both near and far. On the contrary, it is a firm and a persevering determination to commit oneself to the common good, that is, to the good of all and of each individual, because we are really responsible for all. Both of these virtues presume the loving care of the other, so necessary for those who are suffering. But they go beyond mere presence to action, to relieve the sufferings of others when possible. The ultimate goal, of course, is to be instrumental in bringing about the kingdom, where there will be no more tears or pain. But the movement toward this vision is painstakingly slow, especially for those who are suffering from physical or moral evil. Conclusion: human freedom and consciousness, having emerged in the process of evolution, sustained by the Creator, are interpreted as gifts to be used to harmonize relationships with God, others, self, and the created world. Too often these gifts have been used to rupture these relationships through sin, with disastrous consequences for fellow human beings and for creation itself. Although we must maintain a clear distinction between physical and moral evil, we might note how many people see the causes of what we call natural disasters today as both the limits of a material world and abuses of freedom by human beings. In the wake of this most recent Hurricane Sandy, many have raised the question again of global warming and consequently humanity's role in that phenomenon. Even James Patterson's new novel, Zoo, talks about the effects of technology on the environment, the animal world. You can see the high literary circles I run in. The invitation in Christian ethics is to act so as to harmonize the fourfold relationship with God, others, self, and creation. More specifically, nurturing virtues of mercy and solidarity for the suffering world will give some direction to what this world is coming to. People who are merciful and in solidarity with their suffering neighbor near and far will be more fully disciples of Jesus Christ by cooperating with the grace of God, and they will move creation toward its fulfillment in Christ, toward the vision painted for us in the book of Revelation, a world where there shall be no more death or mourning, wailing, or pain. Indeed, a world of a new heaven and a new earth. Thank you.
Kevin, I really liked your characterization, the way you characterized suffering. And I think it was very consistent with what we heard from Daryl this morning about brokenness. But you came back at the end to talk about physical and moral evil. And this is a conundrum, it seems to me, that my colleague Kent and I, when we talk about these kinds of things, we often try to recognize how we are trapped by our language. Mm-hmm. Okay? And when we use evil as a noun, somehow that gives evil ontological status, mm-hmm, in a way that it's perhaps a dilemma, because then we can't get out of that language trap. It's somehow, when we use the word physical as an adjective, mm-hmm, and now as an evil, the evil as a noun, mm-hmm, we somehow have to come back around to that issue beyond anything that we have talked about here, and it persists. It's given a status which is problematic. You see what I'm getting at?
I hear what you're saying, but I haven't heard why.
Well, it's
problematic.
If we can talk about a moral agent.
Yes.
All right. That has a certain cogency to it, mm-hmm, that allows us to talk about destructive acts, mm-hmm, and disastrous acts and so forth, in, mm-hmm, a way that we can bridge the problem. Mm-hmm. But if evil, if we give ontological status, mm-hmm, to evil, It's difficult to get out of that language dead end. I'm not sure I'm making sense.
Well, I hear the words. Evil exists in that.
I don't want to deny the existence of evil. Existence being a qualitative a term that has a distinct meaning, but it's real in our lives in that sense. But it,
yes. I think when we're talking about moral evil, as I was describing it here earlier, about we name something as moral evil when the effect of that action is that it has, you know, harmed, broken these relationships. So if the question is whether should we not speak of evil in general, even evil is always concretized in some way, maybe somebody else.
Can I give...
Carry on your usual conversation.
Evil to me as an adjective makes sense. Mm-hmm. An action may be evil. Mm-hmm. I have a great deal of trouble with the dichotomy of physical evil and moral evil. A tornado to me is not evil. It may be the occasion of tremendous suffering, but it just happened. And it happened perhaps in an area where there were people, and therefore it resulted in suffering. Mm-hmm. If it occurred merely in an open plain, it might mess up the grass, but that's it. So to ascribe, I'm much more comfortable with evil as an adjective. Mm-hmm. And therefore you get into intent, into decision making, which a tornado never did.
Well, sure. Well, but I mean, isn't that the primary distinction between the two? In terms of moral evil, we're saying there's agency here. The other is perhaps, and maybe it's an inadequate attempt to try to describe...
To me, it's a non sequitur, because the physical didn't have an intent. Mm-hmm. It may be the occasion of suffering,
sure,
but to ascribe a tornado as evil makes no sense to me.
If you want to accept evil as the lack of a good that ought to be present, you could then speak of that, you know, that things should have been in order here, this hurricane shouldn't have happened here, Jersey Shore should be great, and it's not anymore. If there's a good that should have been there that's no longer there, we name that then a physical evil. The words, you may not want to do that, but I mean, at least I think that's part of the origin of the term, you know? So, okay.